most physicians, if they are only maxing out their retirement account, are probably not going to be able to retain that lifestyle once they stop working. What happens to the stock market during your first 5 years of retirement actually makes a big difference on whether or not your portfolio is going to last that given time.
That is the voice of today's guest, Dr. Eliza Jung, and you are listening to the Stimulus Podcast. Hello, my friends. How you doing? I hope you're well. For those of you new to the show, my name is Rob Orman. I spent 20 years as an emergency physician and am now a physician coach. My mission is to help docs get unstuck, unburnt, and kick ass in their careers and lives. And this is my pod where we talk about the ways to do that. So welcome. I'm glad you came. Our guest today is Dr. Eliza Jung, MD, PhD, oculoplastic surgeon, and germane to this conversation, purveyor of the growyourwealthymindset.com website, which is her home base as a money coach. And she's also host of Grow Your Wealthy Mindset podcast. Are you getting a theme, my friends? We're going to grow our wealthy mindset today. And Lisa, when we were corresponding before the podcast, you wrote something that I'd like to unpack. And as I saw this, that kind of sounds like a job description. And you said, you help physicians turn their income into wealth and improve their relationship with money. Turning income into wealth. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so as physicians, we tend to make a high income after we finish training, but it's not about what you make, it's what you keep, right? If you have to keep working for money, then you're always having a job, which is just over broke. If you can turn your...
What did you say? Having a job is just over broke? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so if you stop working and your money's not making money for you, then you have no money. If you're spending all your money and you're not getting your money to work for you, then the money will run out. So you're just over broke.
Okay. So turning income into wealth. Let's get to the second part. And that's improving your relationship or improving the relationship with money. And it sounds like you're like a marriage counselor sitting down with the person in their portfolio on the couch, having the heart to heart. And I said, wait, what is it that you see typically needs improving with that relationship?
A lot of physicians, they say, oh, I didn't go to medicine for the money. I want to help people. Yeah. And so we generally aren't the one actually charging patients. Like our front desk might be taking a copay. You know, there's a third payer. Usually we're going through insurance. Maybe you're doing cosmetics. You're more directly related to the money. But we like to actually separate ourselves from money and service. So when it comes to money, a lot of times physicians really have big blocks in their head. So a lot of times we think as physicians, oh, if we want to earn more money, that means working harder or working longer hours. And we know how to work hard as physicians. During residency, we're working 60, 70, 80 hours a week. They had to actually put a cap on how much residents work at 80 hours a week. And so you're actually old enough that you probably worked before that cap. When I started residency, that cap was in place. But when I started medical school, the cap wasn't quite there yet. So I saw that cap go in. And there have been other work hour restrictions since then. When it comes to money, it's not about how much time or energy you spend. Everyone's got limited time or energy. What money is really about is how much value you create, right? How do you have people like Jeff Bezos and Warren Buffett and Bill Gates being like self-made multi-billionaires? It's not because they worked harder. They had the same amount of hours as a day as the rest of us. And Warren Buffett's a little older than probably most of the people living are listening to this podcast. But in the end, it's because they created more value. And that's the same when you look at Taylor Swift. She created value by creating her music. People are willing to pay for her music. People are willing to pay for her concerts. And so she makes millions of dollars doing that with the same kind of time that you and I have. She may be working actually much less hours than you and I worked or have worked in the past.
It seems to be like Taylor Swift is working pretty hard. I just want to just be fair to Taylor Swift. Come on, he's always putting something out there. So when people come to you, are a money coach, and I definitely want to get into what that means. But before we get into the detail on that, like, what is the situation that most people find themselves in when they come to you?
One situation is people who've been letting money just pile up in their bank account and they just don't know what to do with it. And usually it's really at the point where their loans have been forgiven. So now it's, okay, I no longer have my student debt. So now what do I do with all this money? Or it may be prior to that, essentially not knowing how to invest, being fearful about investing, fearing losing money. The second situation is people who, you know, have actually learned something about personal finance. They're good with investing in using index fund investing techniques, but they really want more diversification. They want their wealth to grow faster, and they're interested in exploring other options like real estate, syndications, private equity, but they really just don't even know where to start. And that part is, oh my God, I start hearing about all these different things and I just stop because I don't know what to do. Further down the road, but still getting to that point of fear of losing money. And then the third category of people I would say is people who are burnt out, positions who are burned out, or something's changed in their job so they no longer feel as secure in their job, or they're not sure what the future of their job's going to be. And so they're worried that they're not going to want to keep practicing as long as they thought they would. And so they want to reach financial freedom as fast as possible so that they have another option.
You were mentioning folks who had an idea of investing with all of these different asset classes. And that sounds very logistical of you do this or that. And I wonder what percentage of what you do is strategy and logistics versus mindset?
Yeah, so that actually really varies depending on the client. I actually have one client who came to me for 100% mindset. She knew she had a lot of scarcity around money. She actually grew up in true poverty, like living without running water type of poverty and having food scarcity. So she really wanted to kind of let go of that scarcity mindset because, you know, now she's a physician making good income, doing well, and yet she couldn't even get herself to buy inexpensive things that she knew she would enjoy. So that was really just 100% mindset. But for some people, it's really a lot more strategy. It's actually sitting down and being like, okay, this is where I'm at and this is what I want. So they actually even know what they want, but I'm not really sure what it means to get there. And so then that's really working out strategy of, okay, here are all different options. This is how much education, energy, time, these different options would take. You know, what looks good to you?
Wondering if you could walk me through just kind of the rough strokes of addressing the scarcity mindset. I think that there's a lot of mindsets listening to this right now. And I personally have an aspect of scarcity in how I approach finance. How would you address that?
So tell me more about where you feel like you have a scarcity mindset with money.
In the back of my mind, there is an idea that it can be gone in an instant. Therefore, I am more risk averse than risk accepting in my investments. And I would say fairly frugal in how I spend. And the frugality doesn't always make sense, even like on a micro level, on deciding two items to buy in the grocery store. And when I look at the big picture, actually, that doesn't make too much of a difference. And growing up, my dad had a similar mindset. He was super successful in his work, and he grew up in true scarcity. The degree of which that word could be used would be debatable, but that really rubbed off on me.
When you're at the grocery store and you're looking at two different items, are you thinking like, oh, this would be nicer, but I don't know if I want to spend this much? Let's just say like organic versus not organic. Like the organic's more expensive and theoretically, you know, better.
Yeah.
But you're asking yourself, should I really be spending on the organic? Is that what kind of...
Okay. So that there's an interesting one. So the organic one is interesting because I've made the decision and taken this decision making out of it that if there is an organic option, I will buy it. Granted, there are differing schools of thought on the validity of that. But in my mind, even if there's pesticides, I would rather have the organic pesticides than the non-organic pesticides. And I feel like buying fresh food of that quality will add up over time to an increased health span. And so I value that. So I'd say that that's a unique one because I've made that decision in advance that, all right, there is something that I value. Much like a bike. I have really nice bikes and I'm okay buying a really nice bike, but sometimes it's like these other small items. There's a discomfort. There's just a general discomfort of us. You're like, oh my God, that thing costs this much. I'm uncomfortable buying it.
Yeah. So I want to point out that you said you identify as someone who eats organic. Yeah. So that when you identify as something, you're more likely to stick with it. People who have a hard time getting regular physical activity, if they start saying, I identify as someone who runs every day, that is my identity as a runner, they're more likely to run as opposed to thinking, I need to exercise every day or I need to have some physical activity every day. So that's one way of looking at who do you want to be. The other thing that I want to bring up is you actually said like you value the healthier organic, whether or not organic is healthier, some people debate, but yes, I'm with you. I tend to buy organic if it's available. Once when you spend your money on what you value, then you generally feel good about that, even if it's a high ticket item, like you talked about the bike. So then when you're uncomfortable about maybe spending a lot of money on something, you're probably questioning what the value of it is. Could I do it on my own without this service or this course or the software or whatever you're buying? And what would the difference be? So if you value your time a lot, any person's probably capable of, let's say, doing the dishes, cleaning their house. But if that's not something you like to do and you really value your time, you probably don't feel bad about hiring someone to clean your house and do the dishes. But if you're really having a lot of money scarcity and you're like, but I could do that, and you're not valuing your time, then you're probably not going to hire the cleaner, or you're going to feel really uncomfortable about hiring a cleaner. Oh, maybe this is frivolous. This is something I can do myself. So when you really kind of pinpoint, where are my values and how can I spend from my values so I can have more of what I value, whether that's time, whether that's health, then you can actually pull out of that feeling of scarcity and go ahead and spend so that you can have more of what you value.
I love that. Spend on what you value. I'm going to tell you one thing that I value that might sound a little bit strange, but I value so much a little extra legroom on airplane flights. So I am willing to buy Economy Plus every time I fly. It does feel like an extravagance, but man, so worth it. We're going to get back to our conversation with Elisa in just a moment. But first, this little bit of goodness. Hey, friends. The next cohort of the Flameproof course is starting September 10th, 2024. Flameproof was designed by my coaching partner, Scott Weingart, and I because we saw a need, a gaping chasm, that almost everyone in medicine was shortchanged in their training, having been molded into excellent clinicians, but given virtually no tools for retaining joy and thriving throughout their careers. So what does it feel like to be a Flameproof graduate? Let me read you a note we just got from one of your colleagues. He said, "This course changed my perspective on my job. Now every day I come to work, there's an opportunity to make a positive impact on someone. I went from constantly dreading work and thinking of quitting to being able to enjoy shifts on a regular basis. And that is exactly why we made this course." Because when you think about burnout or frustration or dread or whatever, so many of the recommendations are nebulous or piecemeal. So many of the recommendations are just kind of nebulous or they're piecemeal. We designed Flameproof with methodology that works and gives specific tools to thrive. For example, in our module on shift flow and efficiency, one of the things that we talk about is managing interruptions. What do you usually hear when it comes to interruptions? You hear something like, well, the data shows that emergency doctors are interrupted an average of 10 times per hour. And then nothing. You think, wait, I'm drowning here and you're describing the water. Flameproof gives you the tools, tactics, and strategies to effectively manage things like interruptions and difficult conversations with consultants and sleep disturbance and the whole portfolio of challenges and stressors in acute care medicine. We only offer the Flameproof course twice a year because it is a live online course that we teach in real time and it always sells out. So if you are ready to get Flameproof, jump on in. We would love to have you there. There's a link in the show notes that'll take you to the website so you can learn more. Back to the show. You're talking about time. I used to do every little step of everything on my own because I could. For example, when we scheduled this, we could have emailed it back and forth 15 times, the coordinator schedules, versus I'm just going to pay for a Calendly for the year. And I am trading that money to give me time. And just it adds up to hours and hours over a year. And I hadn't thought of it in quite the way that you expressed it, that buying time. You can't buy time. It's like the one thing you can. I guess it's that you can't get time back. That's the thing. I guess you can't buy time. buying experiences and buying time have become real high value items. And so before the podcast, we were talking about software processing, all of these other things. And every one of the things that we were mentioning, I used to spend inordinate time on. And so now I feel like that's the investment, is like anything I can put into opening up time where I can either just coach or record or create, there's value in that. Whereas if I had looked at the prices for Calendly or the prices for the audio program I used a couple of years ago, I'm like, oh, that's too expensive. Too expensive for what? It was just this reflex of that's too expensive. And that was the end of the sentence. But there is a second part of that sentence.
When you pay for something so that you can get back more of your own time, essentially buying time, how can you enjoy that time as opposed to necessarily just working during that time?
Oh, so well said. So getting back to what you do, and I've never spoken to a money coach before, and I wonder, how is what you do different than a financial planner who asks, what are your monthly expenses? When would you want to retire? What are your savings? What's your risk tolerance, et cetera? Where do you guys overlap, and then where do you diverge?
So I think we overlap in getting out the goals, finding out financial goals, helping our clients set financial goals. But I think it actually probably stops about there. So I'm not a certified financial planner, and I tell all my clients that. I have that all over my podcast. Because a certified financial planner is generally actually going to tell you what to do. And I don't actually tell my clients at all what to do. I give them options, I educate, but it's always their choice. And the other thing is that certified financial planners will typically just, when they tell you what to do, it's invest in these stocks or invest in usually mutual funds and put so much in this and put so much in that and buy your disability insurance and get your life insurance of this much and such. And then they do give you a financial plan, and there is value to a financial planner for certain things. But what they're not going to do is they're not going to talk to you about real estate investing, syndications, private equity. That's really just completely out of their wheelhouse. And they're not really going to help you with your mindset or even help you with accountability to make sure these things get done. So if you pay a fee-only certified financial planner for a financial plan, you'll meet a few times, you'll get the plan, and it's okay, here you go. Now you execute it. Now you may also pay for, okay, like I want you to execute parts of it. And so you may have them have control of the account so that they put the money into whatever mutual funds and they do the tax loss harvesting or whatnot, and you pay them for that. They may send you an email and be like, hey, making sure that you bought your disability insurance, your life insurance, which I generally suggest not buying it from the planner, actually going to a broker who actually really knows insurance, as opposed to someone who's just essentially a salesman selling you. I guess insurance brokers are salesmen, but there's definitely a difference between someone who really knows their different insurance product and is picking the best product for you versus someone who knows what high commission products are and looking to maybe earn a little bit more on the commission.
I will say, because I know they're listening to this, that our financial planners definitely go mindset, definitely go goals. So guys, none of that applies to you.
That's true. There are life planners, and they do go more of a mindset. So there are some certified financial planners that are also life planners, and that's been a subset, but not all certified financial planners are life planners. Some are, and then they do really actually go more into mindset. That's a good caveat.
We've been with our guys for 23 years, and our whole team. And it seems like what they do is they help us formulate an idea of the big picture of what we want things to look like, of here's how much we'd like to have per month. Here's when we'd like to retire. Here's what, all of these things. Okay, there's the big picture. Here's what the granular details could look like that we would put into place. So we are the lead, like the CEOs, and then they're the CFOs. And how about that? Does that give I think that's the job of the financial planner, is to be the CFO of your family corporation. Does that ring true?
Does ring true. A lot of times I actually say that, like, you yourself should be the CFO and use the advisor, and they're an advisor, but you make the final decision.
I want to get back to you. And if you're comfortable with this, what were your biggest financial mistakes when you were starting out? or maybe not even when you're starting out, could be even more recently, that led to you getting where you are, doing what you do?
So I would say trusting other people because they sounded confident and experienced instead of trusting myself. I definitely lost money on that. Even just working with a real estate agent where, oh yeah, this property looks great, this would be a good investment type of thing. And not necessarily doing as much or being swayed more in terms of what to actually do instead of trusting, is this really a good deal? And the other is actually selling real estate that I own instead of refinancing and then holding on to them and renting them out and having them continue to appreciate in value while I was getting cash flow from them.
All right, I want to get that to second, but you're saying that, is this, you said before, is this a good deal? What's the heuristic that you use to say, is this or is this not a good deal?
So it's really about what kind of return on investment I can expect and what are all the downsides? What are all the upsides? Can I handle the downsides? And would the upsides be worth the downsides?
You've mentioned real estate a couple of times, and I imagine that's going to be part of this answer. In what is your personal financial mindset? And maybe even connected to that or not connected to that, what does your financial strategy look like? Big picture and the important details.
I max out my retirement accounts. I do the backdoor Roth conversion. And so that's all in stocks, bonds, index fund investing. And then the majority of my non-tax advantage accounts, I should say, because we do have an HSA as well. So what's not in tax advantage accounts is mostly in real estate and also some private equity as well.
And then what does that real estate investing look like?
So it's changed over the years. I actually started real estate investing pretty young. So I did the medical science training program. It's a joint MD-PhD program. And as we were talking before we started recording, at grad school was somewhat hard time. I had a principal investigator who liked to micromanage quite a bit. And I am not a person who likes micromanagement. And so I already started having this idea of, okay, if I don't want to have to work for somebody else, and how can I make it so that I'm not dependent on a job or working like that? So I started investing at that point. I actually was contributing to a Roth IRA since the time I graduated from undergrad. My parents basically told me like, okay, you finished college, you've got to put money into a Roth IRA. They didn't quite explain what that really meant, but they're like, go to Fidelity, open a Roth IRA and put, I think it was $3,000 back then. And that's what I did. And then I did it every year, but I didn't realize you actually had to invest the money you put in there. And so a few years later, when I started reading about personal finance and investing as a graduate student, and then I read Rich Dad Poor Dad, who Robert Kiyosaki is all about real estate. And I actually started real estate investing at that point. So that's what I mean by, I wish I had kept those houses. So I bought houses super cheap, fixed them up and sold them. And I would actually probably have a lot more wealth if I had refinanced them, kept them, had positive cash flow and had all that appreciation.
Were you there putting in the elbow grease and tearing out walls? Were you hiring that out?
So for the first house, I had to hire the skilled labor work, like putting in your furnace, putting in your roof,
yeah,
redoing the kitchen. But I did the painting myself. I did the gardening, weeding myself. I did whatever I thought I was skilled enough to do. I'm handy, but not like, I definitely couldn't put together a kitchen or a bathroom. I could probably learn, but that was all hired out.
So what does it look like now? Is it individual properties? Is it syndicates?
So I recently just sold my long-term rentals, and that was due to new regulation in the city they were in, which made them no longer as profitable. And so it didn't seem worthwhile. I still have a short-term rental, or what people usually call an Airbnb, which I self-manage, and that cash flows really well. I'm also invested in a number of real estate syndications, as well as in two private equity companies.
So somebody's listening to this thinking, I got a 401k through my job, paying off my debt. I can go on trips. I can buy what I want, keep food in the fridge. What are they not thinking about? What are the important big gaps and steps that they might want to take?
So most physicians, if they are only maxing out their retirement account, are probably not going to be able to retain that lifestyle once they stop working. And this is assuming that you didn't start putting money into your retirement account until you became an attending, which is the case for most people. And that usually doesn't happen until like your mid-30s, I would say, for most physicians. If you do a shorter residency program like family medicine and went straight after undergrad and didn't do any kind of fellowship. Maybe then you start out younger, but still we have a time delay. And then we in general take out a lot of loans for our medical education. And that's something also that has to be paid off. So this is a mistake I find a lot of physicians make, is just thinking maxing out their retirement accounts is going to be enough. That being said, if you max out your retirement account and do max out your backdoor Roth IRA and you work 30 years and max it out for those 30 years, at the end of those 30 years, you'll at a 4% withdrawal rate, if you had a 7% real rate of return, you'd have about $120,000 a year, which you can live on. But if you're generally making I think the average physician makes $330,000 a year. If that's what you're making and you're maxing out your retirement accounts, but you're not putting anything else into investing, and you're spending the rest, then you're spending way more than $120,000 a year.
When you're saying other investments, you've talked about real estate a couple times and having that be a source of regular income. What are the other big buckets to consider beyond that, that are outside of a retirement account?
So private equity is essentially having an ownership in a company, just like a stock is ownership in the company. It's just with private equity, it's not a publicly traded company. And actually, you can invest in real estate through your retirement accounts by investing in REITs, real estate investment trusts. So there is a flavor that you can have in your retirement accounts. And actually, you can also do a self-directed IRA or a self-directed 401k and invest in anything. You could actually invest in real estate syndications or private equity if you go that route. So like when you say your 401k or 403b or 529 or all these things, these numbers are tax codes. And the tax codes just create the ability for you to have tax advantage with investments in those accounts. The thing is, if you go open up your 401k or your IRA at Fidelity, Fidelity only offers investments of stocks, bond funds, stock funds. If you want to buy iBond, you couldn't do that in Fidelity, right? You have to do that through Treasury Direct. The thing to think about is not necessarily, oh, what can you do in your retirement accounts versus outside your retirement accounts? Because in actuality, while you're working and you're contributing to your 401k at your work, you do have to use whatever company account that they have you in. But once you leave there, you can actually transfer it to wherever you want. It doesn't have to be when you're retired, it's just whenever you leave that workplace. So equities, which is investing in a business or company, debt, which is investing in bonds, mortgages, anything where you're loaning money, and real estate. And then I guess commodities would be the other category.
Hey friends, if you haven't already, check out the free resources that we have at roborman.com. These were all made to address specific pain points in medical practice. Scripting your least favorite conversations, my four favorite documentation templates, the quick and dirty guide to calling consults, and the driveway debrief. You can find them all under the freebies tab on the website, or you can click the link in the show notes to get right to them. All right, back to the show. I want to switch gears to FIRE. FIRE. Ah, financial independence. Retire early as made popular by people like Mr. Money Mustache. How do you know when you have reached the threshold of financial independence so that you can retire early? What does that look like?
So I've developed the Financial Freedom Workbook, which is available at my website. And I actually talk about three levels of financial independence, which I call survival FI, and then regular FI, and then fat FIRE.
I never previously heard it broken down like this. I cannot wait to hear.
Yeah, so survival FI or survival financial independence is basically when you have enough passive income from your assets that you can actually live indefinitely, but at a very frugal level. You'll have a place to live, you'll have food on the table, but you're not taking vacations to Europe. You're not spending lavishly on anything. It doesn't leave a lot of room for quote luxury. And this is maybe where the mustache people are. But I think a lot of us would say, I'd rather just go ahead and work more in order to have some of these nicer things in life. I certainly am that.
The money mustache is kind of like $40,000 a year. That's all you need, really. If you need any more, you're just ridiculous.
Yeah. I'd rather work and have more than $40,000 a year to spend.
How do you know how much money you'll need? We're talking about that amount. And it's that like $40,000, having $40,000 of spendable money per year, it is a lot of money. As you make more money, you get lifestyle creep and you think, oh, I expect to live at this certain level. And I don't know if this is a particular number that really people get concrete of, oh, here's exactly how much I want to have for a month. Now, it's going to need to be flexible, but how do you figure that out?
So with regular FIRE, basically you look at, if you're going to continue your current lifestyle, how much money do you actually need to continue your current lifestyle? So how much money do your assets have to generate for you to have that lifestyle? And if your assets is all going to be in stocks and bonds, then there's going to be some amount of selling off those stocks and bonds in order to liquidate so that you have money. Because while stocks do pay some dividends, the dividend yield has actually become quite low with stocks, and bonds do pay more dividends, but generally they appreciate less. So you're going to be selling off probably some stocks if that's all your portfolio. At some point, you'll have, if you have a stock and bond portfolio, you can take a little bit of it, sell it off, have the cash from it, and the rest of your remaining portfolio will continue to grow. And so you'll continue to have assets to fund your future life. So that's when you become financially independent. What's nice about real estate is real estate just gives you cash flow while you hold the investment. So if you've got a rental property and, you know, the tenant's paying rent and the amount of rent they're paying covers all the expenses of the real estate, plus there's additional cash flow on top, then you get to spend that cash flow. You still own that property appreciates over time. So that's one reason I love real estate, is that you get everything plus tax benefits.
With FIRE, when you read about, one of the big things that you see is the 4% rate of return, that if you, and let's just take taxes out of it and say, hey, you've got $1 million saved. You have a 4% annual rate of return. You get $40,000 a year, just your money making money. Am I getting that right?
So the 4% is not the rate of return. The 4% is the withdrawal rate, where financial analyst William Bengen did these studies where at a 4% withdrawal rate, that the chances are of your portfolio lasting at least 30 years was quite high. It wasn't 100%, but it was over 90%. So that's also depends on what's called sequence of returns risk. So if you retire and the stock market crashes like the year after you retire, the chances of your portfolio lasting is actually much less than if your portfolio is growing and the stock market's doing great. What happens to the stock market during your first 5 years of retirement actually makes a big difference on whether or not your portfolio is going to last that given time. And that being said, as an ophthalmologist, I have a lot of older patients. I have a lot of patients in their 90s. So if you're retiring at 65, like you're still thinking about potential 30 years. Yeah. If you're thinking of retiring earlier, like 55, now you've got potentially 40 years that you've got to cover.
Tell me more about Fat FIRE. There's the, what did you call it? The austerity FIRE, or... what was the
survival FIRE?
Survival FIRE. You're there with your flint and wet wood, and you're out in the middle of the, and then you've got FIRE, and then you've got Fat FIRE. What does that look like?
So Fat FIRE is that you're actually going to end up spending and doing more when you're in retirement than you are when you're working. And that makes sense for some people, right? Because especially retiring early and you're young enough that you can still do a lot of things, now you've got time to do those things. If you didn't have time to travel before and now you can travel the world, depending on what level of luxury you like to travel in, you can imagine you can spend a lot more during retirement than you were when you were working. You could also consider if you have a hobby that you're really passionate about and now you've got the time to do it, but it's an expensive hobby like NASCAR racing or flying small airplanes or yachting or playing polo, these are all things that is going to take a certain amount of money in order to build a fund. And so that's what Fat FIRE is, that you actually need a plan to have more money during your retirement years than you had while you were working.
And it's not like one of these is better than the other. There's just different mindsets and different ways of living. And as you're walking through all this, I had never thought of kind of breaking down FIRE into, I had always equated FIRE with the frugal FIRE, with the survival FIRE. And the way that I see that is, if you want to start doing it, start living that way now and understand exactly what that will be like and what that will take and how the numbers really pencil out and how are my investments doing over this period of time, and will that be a realistic thing to stress test every aspect of it yourself. What do you think of that?
Yeah. If you want to fire and retire early, then having a little bit more of a frugal lifestyle can certainly be assistance to that, because now you can have more of your money to save and invest, and that will get you there sooner. And you won't need as much to continue your current lifestyle if you don't let your lifestyle creep up to as high of a level as if you were spending more of your income. I like to tell people to, why not strive for FI, financial independence, and decide on the RE, the retire early, whenever you want. You could do gradual retirement. You could decide, okay, I just want to work 2 days a week. I want to work 1 day a week. I want to work every other week. You can do whatever you want once you reach financial independence. Working becomes your hobby. People will have side jobs or different jobs. It's because they get to. Your regular job could be something you just get to do because you want to do. And you do it because that's how you want to spend your time. And that also puts you in a place where you can really decide, yes, this is how I want to spend my time. Let's say you're a pediatrician. I really just love seeing babies and I don't want to see the adolescents anymore. You build a practice where like you just see babies, and once they get to a certain age, they go to someone else in the practice. Or you could be a surgical subspecialist and be like, you know what? I really only like doing these 5 surgeries or these 2 surgeries, and I'm not going to do these other ones. Everything becomes your choice when you have financial independence, because you could have your own practice, or even if you're employed for someone else and they're like, no, we want you to do all this. Okay, bye. Go find someone somewhere else.
As we wrap, how can people get a hold of you?
So we've mentioned my website, growyourwealthymindset.com. You can also just email me at growyourwealthymindset@gmail.com. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram at Grow Your Wealthy Mindset. Again, you see the theme here.
Elisa, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been illuminating and edifying, a real delight.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that is it for today. And you know what? If you love medicine, but you find the job itself leaves a lot to be desired, I work with docs in your shoes who feel the same way and help them extend their careers and have fun doing it. Can you imagine driving to your next shift with a feeling of stoke and excitement? And then when you leave for the day, you think to yourself, hey, that was pretty damn great. We can help get you there. And you can reach out to me at roborman.com. Until the next time, my friends, be well and keep on rocking.